You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I'm Suzanne DiMaggio, the director of the Asian Social Issues Program here at the Asia Society. Welcome and thank you for joining us this evening for our program entitled Crisis in Burma, In Search of a Unified International Response, which we are co-organizing with the Open Society Institute. I'm also very pleased to welcome listeners who are joining us via live webcast. Welcome to all of you. Tonight's discussion follows up on the emergency town hall meeting that we convened with OSI in the aftermath of the Burmese junta's violent crackdown on thousands of monks and political activists who took to the streets in peaceful pro-democracy protests last fall. Here we are nearly 6 months on from this brutal suppression, and yet the military has stepped up its crackdown on the media and severely curtailed freedom of expression, and political activists continue to be imprisoned. Tonight we are joined by an esteemed panel of experts to examine recent developments in Burma and to address efforts at the international and regional levels to address the crisis. Moderating the discussion will be Maureen Ong Twin, Director of the Burma Project Southeast Asia Initiative at the Open Society Institute. Maureen also serves on the Asia Advisory Board of Human Rights Watch and the Burma Studies Foundation, and she is a very good friend to the Asia Society. Before I turn the mic over to Maureen to introduce the panelists, I'd like to take a few moments to tell you about some upcoming Asia Society programs that you might find interesting. Tomorrow, in this very room, we'll be convening the public release of a new report by the Independent Commission on AIDS in Asia, and our partner in this is UNAIDS. We'll be joined by members of the commission who will present their projections for the epidemic's effect on society and development in the region, and they will also offer policy options aimed at moving the AIDS response forward in Asia. So we hope you can join us for that. On Thursday, my policy colleagues will be organizing a luncheon discussion focused on Trita Parsi's book entitled Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. For this timely discussion, Trita will be joined by Daniel Levy of the New America Foundation and Walter Russell Mead of the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, we have, as usual, several spectacular exhibitions in our museum just downstairs, one of which is enticingly titled Designed for Pleasure, The World of Edo Japan, Prints and Paints. I highly recommend that. You can, of course, check out our website for more details on these events and much more. And, of course, the best way to stay informed about what we're up to here at the Asia Society is to join us. And I think at every seat we conveniently put a membership brochure in case you're interested in doing that. Now, just a couple of last housekeeping announcements. For those who are joining us via webcast, we'd like you to participate in our Q&A discussion that will follow the panelists' remarks. So please email your questions to moderator@asiasociety.org. And finally, for those of you that are joining us here in person, I hope you will join us for a post-discussion reception just in the room behind us that will follow this event. Now, without any further ado, please join me in welcoming Maureen.
Hi, good evening. It's great to see all of you. The title is called Crisis in Burma. I think we should make that a template because we've had a crisis in Burma since last September. We've had one since 88. You could go back to 62 when the military took over. Some people would say we've had it since 1948, when Burma so-called received independence from Britain. So 6 months after the uprising led by the monks in Burma, most of us are wondering why and how the regime manages to stay in power. And I hope that that might be one of the questions that all of you will address, especially our economists, to see just how can they hang on if it's supposed to be, you know, such a terrible economic disaster. And with all the international responses, why doesn't it work? So Dr. Thong Thuan and Scott Maciel, I hope we'll address that. We had quite a thrilling panel in November, and I don't know how many of you were here for that other panel when we had the two monks and Paulo Pinheiro, the special rapporteur on Myanmar for the Human Rights Council. And remember the monk, Ugambira, who called in? I don't know, who was here last time? Anybody here? Do you remember the monk? We had a monk in hiding for those who weren't here. He heard about this panel. He's a young monk. He's only 29 years old. Most of those monk leaders are very young. He called in to the two monks we were having and said, I want to talk to the Asia Society. So quickly we scrambled and we figured out a way to have him called in to the audience. And so he called in and he took questions. And he kept going and going, and we had to basically say, monk, we think you better go back into hiding because that's how they find you. They actually did catch him on November 4th. It was really terrible news for us. And you can imagine what they did to him anyway, because he was like number one on the run. We have a terrific panel tonight. I'm not going to read you their CVs since we can save time for discussion, especially I would like to have as much time for Q&A from the audience. And we also have, as Suzanne said, I think people are emailing us questions from the live webcast. We have a terrific panel, Dr. Thong Thuan, representing the Burmese exile government at the United Nations, Mr. Scott Maciel, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Southeast Asia, the State Department, Professor Sean Turnell, an economist from Macquarie University in Australia. He's the co-founder of the Burma Economic Watch. So without much ado, I'm going to ask each one to come up and speak for 10-12 minutes, and then after he speaks to have a seat here. And then after we're all seated, hopefully that'll be – we have a timekeeper somewhere also. We will open it up for questions. Thank you. Dr. Thong Thuan, would you like to come up?
And situation in our country.
Hello. Yeah, thank you very much for your keen interest in the situation of our country. It is the great honor for me to be with Mr. Scott Maciel and also Mr. Sean Turnell in the same panel here. Also thanks to Asian Society to organize this panel. Because as the title said, that it is the crisis period. And then we need to think about option, how to respond to that crisis situation. As Susan said, that after we witness saffron crackdown on the saffron revolution, the suffering of the Burmese people has never been stopped. The military handed down the activists and monks who were involved in the movement. You know, they searched for the activists who are in hiding, and they also targeted to the young journalists who smuggled out information as well as footages to the exile radio station and TV station. So it is the continuation of the, repression, not just in the city, in the central part of Burma. After the situation in the urban area has been under control, military refreshed the dry season offensive to the Karen area. As you know, the Karen is one of the ethnic nationalities of Burma, and they have been resisting against the regime for the greater autonomy and to get recognition on their the rights, to administer their own area or to preserve their culture, and literature. So in the course of that offensive, just a few weeks ago, we heard that nearly 2,100 villages having displaced. So again, not just the crisis situation is not just in the central part of Burma in the face of ongoing repression, but also human rights and also humanitarian crisis we have witnessed in the ethnic minorities area, especially in Karen area. Of course, as Mamorin said, that after the Saffron Revolution, we had couples of UN Security Council briefing on Burma, and Secretary General dispatched his advisor, Mr. Gambari, to the region, hoping that UN will be able to play some sort of role to find a solution for Burma. Unfortunately, regime rejected almost all of the recommendation made by Mr. Gambari, and as well as recommendation made by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in his letter to the senior general Tan Shui. And they rejected the idea of having permanent presence of the UN, having a liaison officers, rejected the recommendation to have a time-bound dialogue with Aung San Suu Kyi, rejected recommendation to release political prisoners. They even said that there are no political prisoners in Burma. And the General Cho San, the information minister, said that those who are in prison are there because of the violation of the existing law, and you know they are criminals. And they also rejected the idea of bringing ethnic nationalities and NLD together and to begin a kind of participatory and democratic and transparent constitutional dialogue. So just before the last visit of Mr. Gambari, regime announced that they have already completed their constitution, and they announced the plan to organize the referendum in May, and also the the new election and 2010. So despite the illusion of constitutionality and democracy, if we look at the principle and basic principles adopted in the SPDC's National Convention process, the reality of an undemocratic and illegitimate military regime remains unchanged. I'm referring to the principle and basic principle of the National Convention because I have not yet seen the constitution they said completed. It has, even though they are saying that referendum is going to be in May, the people of Burma have not yet got the opportunity to see the constitution and for what they have to vote for. So that is the situation. So the constitution proposed by the SPDC is the one, obviously, to legitimize the military rule, ignoring the aspiration of the people, to build a democratic society. So the new election that the regime had proposed would not permit the participation of many political figures and also many well-experienced politicians in the last 20 years, as well as well-known political figures like the leaders of the 88-88 generation student groups. Because, in the basic principle, regime talk about the qualification to be an elected MPs. And one of the qualification is that, that those who have the criminal record and those who have been subjected to the prison terms will not be eligible to contest in the new election. So now they are saying that there are no political prisoners, all those in prison are criminals, means that those political figures who led the democracy movement and most of the elected MPs of the 1990 election or activists who actively took part in the movement in the 20 years will be automatically out. So it's obviously that the new constitution is designed to marginalize those democratic forces and to set up a kind of sham government and parliament, which will be mostly dominated by the regime and their cronies. And I believe you are already aware about regime's plan to marginalize Aung San Suu Kyi in the media. They also said that to be the head of the state, you know, that somebody should not be linked with, you know, the foreign spouses, or, you know, should not have some link with the foreign countries, because Aung San Suu Kyi was married to Michael Arias. One of the regime ministers already said that she cannot be in the future political life of Burma. This is the kind of constitution the regime is talking about. But anyway, Burmese democracy movement, in particular the government in exile, has proposed a way out for that crisis and suffering for the Burmese people through the good offices of the UN Secretary General. So we are not looking for the revolution or violent overthrow of the regime, but a peaceful transition to a situation where Burma is stable but democratically governed. What we require is a kind of constitutional process which includes all party concerned, including the military, democratic parties, and also representatives of the ethnic groups, and make up a kind of, you know, that's kind of a interim arrangement for a democratic transition in Burma. We are not talking about rewriting the SPDC, military proposed constitution, completely. We are talking about a kind of constitutional dialogue, you know, to look into the some of the provision in the military's proposed constitution, which marginalize, you know, the participation of all party concerned, and we think that we can work together for the nation building if military change their mindset from the mode of military has to play the role in future political life of Burma to the mode of sharing responsibilities, you know, to rebuild the union. So we are looking more forward to a kind of democratic transition and kind of interim constitution, which is designed to accommodate all players, including the military. But of course, we have to guarantee that constitution in minimum must guarantee the basic human rights of the people, you know. Without having basic human rights, we cannot dream to build a democratic society. And we are hoping a kind of interim constitution at least guarantee social and cultural rights of the ethnic nationalities, and guarantee that there will be non-discrimination based on the ethnic background. So we are hoping a kind of interim constitution and minimum that guarantee rule of law. Without having rule of law, we cannot have a successful economic transition, and we cannot have a market economy, and we cannot talk about the modern Burma as SPDC is claiming for. And then we also need to give the hope to the people that this is the kind of interim arrangement aiming for a national reconciliation. And at one point, you know, there will be the chance to amend the constitution. You know, that's, we look at constitutional making a kind of evolution process. And then, you know, we hope that when the time and the development of the country is ripe enough, of course, we must fulfill the dream of the people. Dream of the people is that, you know, that a kind of governance within the framework of a federal democratic constitution. But unfortunately, SPDC doesn't seem to, you know, that be ready to accommodate our call for it, you know, that that kind of negotiation and compromise. So they are more seem to be determined to impose that kind of constitution which will guarantee the domination of the military. So in such a situation, constitution military proposed will be rather problem than the solution. We have already heard about the voices almost every day from inside Burma. You know, almost all political forces and, you know, that already make the public announcement that they cannot accept the constitution proposed by the regime, and they are going to resist unilateral imposition. And also, the NLD, the National League for Democracy, state divisional level and also township levels, organizing committees during these days are having meetings, and they are making decision and public announcements that they are going to oppose the SPDC proposed constitution. So the political tension is growing higher and higher almost every day, not just the Burmese Democratic Forces, but we also heard voices from the ethnic nationalities. We heard that the ethnic nationalities like the Wa and Kokan and even Mon, and they are saying that they are not happy with that constitution, and then it will be difficult for them to accept. So the most possible scenario in the near future, if SPDC try to impose it unilaterally, there will be more political confrontation, and we cannot rule out the possibility of another saffron type the mass movement in the future around the issue of the referendum. That's why we want to alert the international community to start to think about a rapid response mechanism for as a short-term measures, how the international community will respond if there is another set of political confrontation and sort of mass movement happen inside the country. You know, we have to think about it. And then I would like to go back to the UN. You know, why the UN or Mr. Gambari is not able to bring a tangible result in the last trip? I think that, you know, it is unfortunate that the international opinion and approach with regard to Burma issue is very much divided. You know, we still need to put a lot of efforts to get a consensus idea how to approach the issue. And then when we talk about political reform and democratic transition, we have to find out what can be the parameters that can be agreeable by all international players. Unfortunately, you know, that the UN role has been undermined, I think, starting from the time of the ASEAN summit, when ASEAN summit rejected the plan of Mr. Gambari, you know, to have a briefing to the whole ASEAN leaders. You know, unfortunately, when the invitation was made by Singapore, and Mr. Gambari was already there, but there was division within the ASEAN, even regarding the issue of Mr. Gambari briefing to the summit. And that kind of division and that kind of lack of unity within the ASEAN when it comes to the Burma issue made the regime more arrogant. That's why nowadays we started to see the regime is arrogant, and then now they completely snapped to the UN. So in that case, we need to refresh the role of the good officer's mandate. Refresh in the way of strengthening the mandate. Of course, you know that the current mandate came from the General Assembly. So the Burmese Democracy Movement would like to see the UN to consider a kind of binding resolution which is going to provide mandate to the Secretary General God offices. We are still hoping that, you know, if the international community take action in a concerted manner and coordinated manner, I think finding a solution through the facilitation of the good offices is still possible. That's one thing. And then when we talk about binding resolution, we know that it's not an easy task because we have China, Russia, and all the regional actors. In that aspect, we have a mechanism called the Friends of Burma, UN Friends of Burma Group, you know, which can bring all the players from the West, from the democratic communities, or countries from the region, including China, together. I wonder, you know, that if such kind of meeting can be hosted by the country like Indonesia in the region, you know, that it will be difficult for the regime to argue that this is the attempt of the Western country to interfere the internal affairs, because there are the host is the one from the region. The Indonesia has abundance of experience from transition from military rule to democracy. If they send the delegation around in 1993 during the Suharto period to learn about Indonesia constitution, I think they should also try again to learn about the changes in Indonesia and how Indonesia is going forward. So that kind of Friends of Burma meeting has to be organized in the near future. Of course, when we think about the Burma issue, we have to think about short-term measures as well as long-term measures. You know, of course, change, I believe, and Burmese people believe that we are the primary players and we have to do our work. And I believe that even though there are risks and our people inside the country are ready to take the risk and to pay the price, we need to empower the people inside. That's important. We have to help them in terms of technology and knowledge and, you know, sharing experience of other transition. At the same time, we have to engage, especially I would like to request the United States to continue to engage with China and other regional players at a high level and then bring them together. I think the struggle of the people from inside, combining with, you know, that's the support of our friends around the world, I believe can bring about change in our country. But for the time being, it is a very challenging period, and we need to be alert, and we should start to consider how we are going to respond if there is another crisis like Saffron Revolution happen around the issue of referendum in May. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Bunker. Go ahead and sit down right here.
While Mr. Scott Marcel is coming up, anybody in the back, there's a whole row that's free up here, and that's reserved, but it's, nobody's going to sit on it. And the row here also will be getting empty one by one. So there's 7 empty seats up here. Don't be shy. Please come. Okay, be shy. Anybody else in the middle want to move? You can too. Please, Scott.
Thank you very much, Maureen, and I want to thank the Asia Society for organizing this event and for giving me an opportunity to come and speak about how the U.S. government sees things in Burma and what we're trying to do to achieve some progress or help the Burmese people actually achieve some progress. I can't tell you how intense the involvement of the administration has been on this issue. The U.S. government's been intensely involved diplomatically on this issue, actually for many years, but certainly especially so since the events of September of last year. And what I thought would be useful maybe today is to talk for a few minutes about a couple things. Why? Why do we care so much? What do we see fundamentally as the problem, and what do we see as the solution, and how we see getting to that solution. So why do we care? It may seem obvious, and maybe it is obvious. I think there's two fundamental issues here. One, we're a nation based on freedom. We favor freedom everywhere, and Burma is such a compelling case of freedom and democracy having been suppressed that none of us can ignore it. We feel very strongly that we have a responsibility to help the Burmese people achieve the freedom that they deserve and the democracy they deserve. The second is more maybe traditional or geopolitical. Frankly, we're worried about the country. We're worried about the direction Burma's going in and the impact it could have on the region. In my view, what you have here is decades of misrule and repression by an increasingly isolated government that's resulted in Burma, which, you know, 45 years ago was a leading light in Southeast Asia, going through a period of steady decline. It's human rights and democracy, but it's not just that. It's economic decline, and I'm sure Sean will talk more about that. It's decline in the education system, in the healthcare system. It's continuing ethnic strife and civil war. And so if you look at any of the indicators, Burma is falling. Whether it's corruption, where Transparency International ranks it, I think, the second worst or most corrupt country in the world, malnutrition levels, education levels. And what are Burma's major exports these days in addition to jewels and timber and energy? It's refugees. It's dangerous drugs. And it's dangerous diseases, which I think everybody in the region is quite concerned about, and we are too. So, and then, of course, as we saw in September, the result is very obviously an incredibly frustrated population that's suffering greatly and showed its frustration and with tremendous courage went out into the streets in September knowing that the risks of brutal repression were very high. And I think the outlook and our concern is that if the situation doesn't turn around, the prospect of more turmoil and more instability will only grow. That's the problem. The solution, there's no easy solution. That's clear. The country faces huge problems that would challenge any government. But the current government lacks legitimacy, it lacks support, and it lacks the ideas to begin to address all the problems the country faces. In our view, the only way for Burma to begin to turn things around is to make a transition to a more representative government that has legitimacy, support, and ideas. This, in turn, can only happen, it seems to us, if the political process is broadened so that the opposition, ethnic minority groups, and the people of the country are able to participate fully and freely in it. That's why the international community, including the United Nations, has been repeatedly calling for an inclusive political process, which we think should begin with initiation of what Aung San Suu Kyi has called a meaningful and time-bound dialogue between the regime and the representatives of Burma's opposition and ethnic minority groups to promote reconciliation and move toward a peaceful democratic transition that the Burmese people can support. We recognize, as does the Burmese opposition, that the Burmese military has an important role to play in this process. Unfortunately, the regime so far has rejected this approach and has failed to cooperate with the United Nations. The generals are stubbornly sticking to their so-called roadmap. And as you all know, they've announced the next step of that roadmap, which is a referendum in May to approve a new constitution. Some have argued that the regime's announcement of a referendum, it's a positive step. Why not? It's at least a step. We disagree. The Constitution itself is the product of an illegitimate process that excluded input by key democratic and ethnic minority representatives. In addition, the referendum itself can only be a positive step if it's credible, which would require it to meet international standards, and if it's part of a broader process of genuine dialogue. Based on what we've seen to date, we have very serious concerns about the credibility of the proposed referendum and its prospects for contributing to the process of national reconciliation and dialogue. Let me just cite a handful of examples. There's a long list. First, the Constitution was drafted in secret by a group handpicked by the regime with no debate allowed. It still hasn't been published or distributed to voters. Second, the regime has enacted laws that provide for severe penalties for expressing opposition to the Constitution. Third, many opposition leaders who should be very active participants in this process are in prison or under some other form of detention. Fourth, the regime has rejected calls for international monitoring of the referendum. Fifth, this all takes place in the context of the regime having taken no steps at all toward establishing a dialogue or opening up the political process. The list goes on. But it's clear at this point the regime is creating the conditions for a fundamentally flawed referendum that will worsen rather than improve the political situation. What are we trying to do about it? In our view, it's critical that the international community do all it can to encourage or you can use the term pressure the Burmese regime to change its approach, to begin a dialogue, to move toward an inclusive political process. And if it does decide to go ahead with this referendum, to make it credible. We support the United Nations and Ibrahim Gambari's efforts, but it's not enough just to say we support the UN. We think all the countries in the region and the international community should use whatever influence they have to try to push the regime, to try to move the regime. China, India, ASEAN, Japan, the EU, as well as the United States and many others. We all have a role to play because it takes consistent and coordinated international pressure. I think you mentioned, you know, the divisions within the international community, and there certainly are some. On the other hand, when I look at the big picture, it's striking to me that there's actually widespread agreement on a number of points. One, that the status quo is a disaster and it is likely to lead to worsening conditions. Secondly, that there's a need for some kind of broadening of the political process to include the opposition ethnic minority groups and to begin reforms and some kind of political transition. Now, there's lots of disagreement on the tactics and the details and the role that various bodies, including the United Nations Security Council, should play. But I think it is kind of striking that there's a lot of agreement in the international community that something has to change. In terms of the referendum itself, we've already seen a number of ASEAN foreign ministers from Indonesia, Singapore, for example, speaking out and stressing the need for an inclusive political process, a credible referendum for international observers. President Arroyo in the Philippines recently reiterated the importance of international observers, international monitors, and said it was no threat to Burma's sovereignty. So you're already getting a lot of this from the international community. We think it's important to continue. Our influence, as you know, is limited. One of the tools we have sought to use and one that's generated a certain amount of controversy is sanctions, economic sanctions. We've had a number of sanctions against Burma for many years. Recently, we've imposed additional sanctions targeted at the regime, its cronies, those who support it. It's commonplace when I travel in the region to hear people say, sanctions don't work. So far, they haven't. What's missing from that sentence, though, is, and neither has anything else, including lots of years of engagement by many others. So on the one hand, we all need to be somewhat humble and accept that none of our approaches to date have worked. But in our view, it's important to continue to pressure the regime, to put pressure on the regime and its leadership, because otherwise they're not going to change. These guys are still earning enough money from energy exports and gem exports and timber exports, that even if the economy as a whole is failing, the regime and leadership is able to stay afloat. So that we need pressure, and that's what we've been doing, is very targeted sanctions, financial sanctions against individuals, cronies who support the regime. We think this is a very useful approach. Let me just mention a word about the UN Security Council. The Security Council has been seized with this issue for some time. It's always hard to get consensus in Security Council, but there was a very strong statement by the Security Council in October calling on the regime. And this was a consensus document out of the Security Council calling on the regime in October to release political prisoners, open up the process, begin to make a change. So we think the Security Council needs to stay engaged. We will certainly do our part to make that happen. Bottom line, without the release of political prisoners and the kind of dialogue and inclusive political process and political transition I've described, Burma is simply not going to be able to solve its problems. And the problem of Burma is going to remain. It's not going to go away. In fact, it's likely to get worse, bringing more problems to not only the Burmese people but to the region and increasing the risk of instability and turmoil. That's why the international community, in our view, should resist the temptation to accept illusions of progress and support the Burmese people in insisting on real, tangible moves that allow the people of Burma to decide their future. Thank you.
Last but not least, Sean Turnell. There's still some seats up here for those who are getting more aggressive. Come on out.
Thanks, Maureen. If there's one salient fact that best illustrates the poor economic performance of Burma, it's this. At the dawn of the 20th century, Burma was the richest country in Southeast Asia. At the dawn of the 21st century, Burma is the poorest country in Southeast Asia. Now, what connects those two points? Well, what connects those two particular poles is the fact that we've had in place for nearly 50 years now a military regime that has not only grabbed the lion's share of Burma's productive resources down those years, but has systematically undermined and dismantled the institutions that the country needs to achieve any sort of economic development. So that's the pessimistic story, and that really is the story. And from that comes a natural solution and so on as well. But I just want to be optimistic for a moment, or inject some optimism, because everything I'm going to say hereafter is going to be terribly pessimistic, as I've given already. But let me just inject some optimism, and that's just simply this. There was a time when Burma did have the sort of institutions that you would want to see for economic development. It's in its own history. This is not an abstract idea. It's not coming from the World Bank or the IMF or anything else. If we look at Burma's own history, I said it was the richest country in Southeast Asia at the end of the 19th century. And the reason for that was that it had the institutions we'd want to see. It had the rule of law of enough. It had property rights. It had sound monetary and fiscal policy and so on. So in a sense, from that comes the solution to Burma's problems. Now, of course, it's still a $64 question about how you get a regime in such that those sorts of institutions can come into place. But in any case, the solution is in Burma's own history. Burma became the world's largest rice producer in the 19th century. It's a dramatic story. It's a story of epic and an epic story of endurance of the Burmese cultivators. It's a story indeed akin to similar sorts of stories from the United States and Australia and so on that transformed wilderness into something enormously productive in terms of economics. So it's been done before, and Burma can do it again if and when a reasonable regime came into place. Okay, but the fact is, of course, to return to the pessimism, there is no such reasonable regime in Burma at the moment. And if we look at Burma today, we can see that it's a country where there is no effective property rights, there's no respect for contract, there's no such thing as the rule of law and so on. If we look at macroeconomic policy making, we can see that policy making is erratic, it's arbitrary, and it's almost completely irrational. I think many people in this audience will be aware of many of the various episodes attesting to this down the decades. I mean, most recently we've seen the movement of the capital from Rangoon to Naypyidaw in 2005, a move that was informed, as so much economic policy in Burma is, by the advice of soothsayers and clairvoyants and so on, such that the move took place, for instance, at 6:37 a.m. on a Sunday morning. People were suddenly ordered to move up country, etc., because this was particularly auspicious and so on. But there's lots of other examples. Burma just recently signed a deal to buy a nuclear reactor from Russia. Estimated cost, about $300 million. The ostensible reason for this was that a nuclear reactor would allow Burma to produce medical isotopes. Now, this is quite interesting in a country that spends 1.4% of GDP on health and education combined. According to UNICEF, it has the worst health system in the world, apart from that in Sierra Leone. So I think the idea perhaps that it's really producing medical isotopes might be somewhat doubtful. More extreme examples, of course, down the years. In the mid-1980s, there was the famous episode where the currency was demonetized. Burma, like most countries, had a decimal system. There was a sudden decision of the leader at the time to remove this, replace the decimal system with one based on the number 9. And that was simply because, again, on the advice of soothsayers and astrologers and so on, that the number 9 was particularly auspicious for Burma and for the general at the time as well. And so we saw the disappearance of 100 jat notes in Burma's currency, replaced by 90, 50s replaced by 45s, a 35 jat note, which is sort of strange enough in itself, replaced by a 27 note, etc., etc. So that's the sort of decision that you tend to see. Even now, if we were to visit Burma right now, We would see that the country is being transformed by the planting of what the Burmese regime call physic nuts, which are more scientifically known as jatropha. It's an effort to come up with some sort of biofuel, but what's fascinating about this is that it's not only across the countryside, and there's supposedly about 7 million acres that are going to be planted with this jatropha, but people are being urged to grow it in their living rooms and on their balconies and so on. And the biggest problem with this is that Burma has no facilities to process this biodiesel at all. When one of the ministers in Burma, this was put to him, how are people going to deal with this? And his suggestion was essentially that stovetop coffee makers be used to grind these jatropha nuts into some sort of residue, which you can then pour straight into the fuel tank. So I suspect we might see all sorts of abandoned vehicles on the side of the road in Burma before too long. But all of these episodes are just the most spectacular of the decisions that that have transformed Burma's economy for ill. More routinely, we see a regime that just claims more of Burma's resources than, in fact, the country can support. And so, and indeed that the political system will allow. So, for instance, the Burmese regime spends vastly in excess of what it can collect in taxation. Now, the answer to that for them, as it is for Robert Mugabe in the moment in Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, etc., is to just print money. And, of course, we get the predictable outcome of that, which is rampant inflation, monetary chaos. And it's from that fact that really every other poor macroeconomic decision really comes from. With all that sort of distortion, it's not possible at the moment to conduct reasonable policy in Burma. Again, to give you a sort of real-life example of that, I think many people here will know that famously Burma has widely divergent exchange rates. So, again, this currency, the jat, officially is linked to the US dollar. It's 6 jat to 1 US dollar. But unofficially, it's 1,000 jat to the US dollar. And you can see the corruption incentive, apart from the distortions that this causes. The corruption incentive, of course, is fairly obvious, given that anyone with connections can buy US dollars for 6 jat and then turn around immediately into the black market and sell it at 1,000 and yield an enormous profit. So that's where a lot of Burma's energy goes. A lot of the would-be entrepreneurs are engaged in the black market and all of those sorts of activities, which, of course, just saps the nation of energy and so on. Burma's firms are mostly owned by the military or people connected to it, and as Scott mentioned earlier, it's been named by Transparency International as the second most corrupt in the world. So, again, another area where Burma is engaging in sort of world's best practice, if you like. Yet another area, of course, is that up until recently it used to vie for Afghanistan to be the world's largest producer of opium. Afghanistan, I'm afraid, has grabbed the market share that Burma had on that front. But proof, I suppose, of the entrepreneurial activity on that front, at least, Burma has now emerged as the world's largest producer of methamphetamine. So they've essentially just diversified. What I might do, I was going to talk just some little more about health and education, so I've briefly touched upon health and similarly problems with education in that illiteracy rates, for instance, are now much worse than they were in the colonial era. And it's also the case that only about 25% of Burmese kids actually complete school. But I might just pick up on a question that Maureen asked at the beginning, which was, given all of this, how on earth has the regime survived? Well, it's interesting because at first I think it survives essentially through the extraordinary resilience of the Burmese people in the face of all this suffering. But now an extra element, and a very, very dangerous element, has entered into the equation, and it's one that makes me even more pessimistic, I'm afraid, for the future than I would be otherwise. And that's gas. Burma has emerged as a very serious producer of gas, of natural gas. Now, at the moment, most of that gas is pumped into Thailand. There's two big fields in the Gulf of Martaban. The produce of that is, as I say, piped into Thailand. And that gives the regime around $1 to $2 billion, depending on gas prices, of course, but $1 to $2 billion worth. Now, 10 years ago, that didn't exist. And the regime really did live a sort of hand-to-mouth existence when it came to foreign exchange. Now it's flush with foreign exchange. Now, to make matters... Now, that sounds sort of good at one level, and I'll come to that. But just to take the gas story a little bit further as well, in the last couple of years, even more gas has been discovered in the Bay of Bengal. This gas is at least as large, the gas fields there is at least as large as the ones that go into Thailand. There was a bidding war a couple of years ago, only just settled, in which China has won the bidding for that gas. Now, that gas is going to come online soon. We're not quite sure when yet. It was originally going to be starting to be gassed into China from 2009. It looks like there's been some strange things going on just in the last couple of weeks, and it looks like there might be delays on that, so it won't be till 2011. But anyway, that's going to add about another $1 to $2 billion going into the regime. Now, the big problem with this, of course, I'm sure I'm not telling anyone in this audience anything new, just to say that the resources curse is a very real issue. And where it's most serious is in countries that lack fundamental institutions. Now, it's the case that in other countries, it's the resources that cause the bad institutions. What we've got, of course, in the situation as Burma is that the institutions are bad to begin with. And on top of that, we're going to impose a regime, give to a regime that has proved so inept so far, an awful lot of money and an awful lot of ability to resist the demands of their citizenry, who, of course, won't be taxed in the normal way. Now, there's just one final thing that I wanted to mention on that, which again relates to Maureen's point, and it just illustrates too that the regime is not just incompetent, but very often a lot of these poor economic decisions are quite deliberate. And again, it relates to the gas. One of the really interesting things about this gas, I mentioned, is about $1 to $2 billion. Now, where does it go? Because again, this sounds sort of good at one level. Where does the money go? Well, interestingly enough, if you look at the accounts, the public accounts of the Burmese government, what you'll find is that these gas revenues are booked into the accounts at the official exchange rate. So $1 billion equals 6 billion jat. Now, 6 billion jat is not anywhere near enough to cover Burma's government spending, and so we get the money printing and all the rest of it. Bring those US dollar gas earnings into the accounts at the market exchange rate, and Burma's fiscal deficit disappears. The money printing disappears. All those macro problems that come from that disappear. In other words, what's happening is that this money is being deliberately kept aside from the public accounts of the government and in no way goes into the rest of the economy to spend on health and education and so on. So this is quite a deliberate decision. And this is the sort of thing that one must fear out into the future as well as these gas revenues increase. All right, well, I might end there and take questions later.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you very much. So we have a good half hour at least for Q&A. If anybody has a question to start out with, yes. Sir, could you speak into the microphone and identify yourself?
It's, I run a website, Sustainability Tank, involved at the UN. Now, when one looks at Burma, it reminds of Nigeria, of Iraq. Basically countries that had a lack of luck of having energy. That means basically what's happening is that the fact that they have those resources has actually destroyed the country. Now, a son of mine, from his law school, I won't mention the name of the law school, went over to the Thai side of Burma, where these law students were actually trying to get the Burmese that came over from a certain tribe, because the oil is found in areas where the minorities live, and their land is being destroyed and they cannot live. And I mean, there's a lot of things that were not mentioned that actually have rotten the country, as you said, on intent. Now, these students were teaching the Burmese how to write up evidence as if some kind of an international court will ever really look into that evidence and come up with a result. With this kind of a situation, is there anything short of creating a lack of market for their energy exports? And that's something you'll never get, because obviously China will want that and Russia will want to sell that nuclear reactor for the money that you explained very nicely how that money actually is being done into dust, and then they will end up having this kind of a reactor as a piece of hardware that is not needed. And I will just give you from my own experience an example in a different country, different environment.
Do you have a question also?
My question is very much. I'm simply throwing at the panel things that were not mentioned, which are actually the resources that have destroyed the country. And if there is no way of get from inside the country some kind of a handle of that, you are not going to get there a Bhutan where the democratization really came from the inside. Burma is not Bhutan. Right. Burma is much closer to examples of countries that have had a delta, and the delta had oil.
So
the question is, can you explain in the light of the resource why right. Burma actually hasn't moved in those 45 years up rather than down?
Okay. So who wants to take that question?
Really,
I
very bad
lot,
governance.
But that is
very
it.
Very bad governance. That terrible policy and massive corruption.
Dr. Van Kuhn?
That's it? You know that the mismanagement regime gave priority to the, you know, that army rather than the welfare of the people. That's very obvious.
Would you agree with me that this is not mismanagement, but this is plain and simple rape? Is that you have inside the country.
Excuse me, sir. Let's have the...
destroys the country on intent.
We all hate the Burmese regime. So, Sean, do you have an answer to that?
Other than just to reiterate that that the problems began before the appearance of resources, but of course the appearance of gas and so on is just going to exacerbate things. And one of the things that I do worry about is that to some extent there's a degree of optimism that we may move to a situation where a regime emerges which is not fully democratic, but it has elements thereof and so on. And what worries me a little bit about that is that the track record of such governments when in possession of substantial resources is not particularly good. So, I would just share that pessimism, I suppose.
I want to ask Dr. Thangtun whether it might be also the whole country has bad karma, you know, being... What do you think about that? I mean, most people are Buddhists. And, you know, you just wonder, what on earth and why so long? What do you think, Dr. Thangtun? In the last life, what were we? Were we Nigeria?
It was the mistake of our forefathers to keep General Ne Win in the army. You know, he should be dismissed in the early days because there were leaders within the army or, you know, early days of the Burmese independence movement who strongly suggested General Aung San to dismiss General Ne Win. But he was so patient.
It's General Aung San's fault. No, sorry. Benny, would you then... identify yourself, please, Benny.
It's on. Benny Widiono. I'm from Indonesia by way of the United Nations. I would like to say that Mr. Thangtun, I think, placed too much emphasis on the role of ASEAN. He says that the government of SPDC is so cocky because ASEAN is divided. In my opinion, I think the whole thing revolves on economics. You see, actually, if we look at Cambodia, for instance, it was bled to death by sanctions. So it could be done, but because, of course, China was on the side of the Khmer Rouge at that time, and therefore controlled the Jam Strait. So my question is, can't you really have more sanctions? You know, the last two speakers on economics, because now the problem is, of course, I think that China is continuing not to ignore the regime and so my question is that
that's for you, Scott, and is it for Dr. Thangtun or the last two? Or all of them?
My objection was to Dr. Thangtun saying right. that ASEAN, but actually my question is
for
the last two.
Two okay.
Because economic sanction can only be done by the US and China, not ASEAN, you see.
Okay.
A couple things. I mean, one, if I understood you correctly, on Cambodia, I mean, the Cambodian economy, my understanding is, was not destroyed by sanctions but by the Khmer Rouge. So I think the Khmer Rouge destroyed, you know, virtually the whole society. And Indonesia, as you well know, played a very important role in bringing about that peace process. Sanctions, you know, sanctions are not a panacea. They don't solve the problem. We all know, all of us who've looked at sanctions know that the history and the track record. What we're saying is that it's important to try to move this regime in a positive direction for there to be internal and external pressure. The internal pressure obviously comes from the people of Burma. Externally has to come from the international community. That pressure or encouragement, if you want to call it that, can take many different forms. It may be quiet diplomacy. It may be public statements. It may be sanctions. We think sanctions particularly targeted at specific individuals and cronies who are supporting the regime help to some extent. They don't by themselves solve the problem, but I think they can play a helpful role.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd just like to echo that. One of the things I think is interesting about the sanctions debate is very often I think people look at the general system of sanctions, but what's emerged in the last few years is some very clever sanctions from this country and from the EU and from countries like Australia and so on as well, which is to look at the financial aspect, to target particular individuals and to target the flow of money in and out of Burma. So in other words, you're targeting precisely the people who you would want to target. So I think that the whole sanctions debate to some extent has moved on, and there's some very interesting things taking place on that at the moment. And I suppose the other thing is that with sanctions, I think we should always look at those as just a vehicle to an end. They're not an end in themselves at all, because Burma, of course, is not poor because of sanctions. And so really we just, I think the question about sanctions is that will that enable a new government to come into power which will handle the economy much better and that's the sort of criteria I think we should employ on the sanctions.
Sean, can I just step in here? Where this huge amount of money that they've, you know, where they get it from the gas money's come in and they set it aside, where is that, do you think?
Well, this is an enormously controversial area. A lot of it probably sits in the accounts of Burma's largest bank that deals in foreign exchange, the Myanmar Foreign Trade Bank. Most of it's probably sitting there because there's a view, and I think it's an accurate one, that that the leaders don't want the funds too far away from them in any case. And there's all sorts of stories that you hear from people in Burma about that sometimes this money is literally in cash. And there's a particular story that a large godown or storage facility is being built at the back of Than Shwe's house where he keeps all this US dollar cash. But apart from that, and apart from it being perhaps in the vaults of the Myanmar Foreign Trade Bank, there's all sorts of stories around various countries assisting Burma in its money laundering and other operations. And, you know, one could pick up from a number of countries, from China to Singapore to Thailand and various others. So I think that's where we should be looking to.
Thank you. Could you keep your questions very to the point so that we can take a lot of them, okay, if you don't mind not making a lot of comments? Go ahead, the lady here, and then gentleman, and then we'll go back there. Can you? Can't hear you.
Thanks. Some observers have indicated recently that there may be a split developing within the military between the more liberal-educated, more liberal-minded and better-educated people who are working the computers and involved in all the tech activities, and the infantry who are currently on top. Is that accurate? Is it relevant?
Could you identify yourself, please?
Sorry, Gloria Spivak.
Okay. Is that for Dr. Thornton, or
it's for anyone who wishes to answer?
Yes, we have seen some members of the SPDC cabinet try to look for a solution to the economic crisis. Some realize that the country is going down. For example, in the last 2 years, we found that some cabinet minister signed the Chamber of Commerce and, you know,
Women Entrepreneur Association to have a brainstorming with, you know, some Burmese economists, and then ask them to provide some sort of recommendation. So as far as we know, that kind of recommendation had already been submitted to the cabinet. But the problem is that, you know, in the Burmese hierarchy, the minister is nothing. Even prime minister has no decision-making power. Most of the power is consolidated in the hands of Senior General Tan Shui. And if he turn down, if he doesn't want to move ahead, you know, nobody cannot push him. That's a problem. But, of course, there is the different sort of thinking and opinion, and there may be some generals who are willing to see the sort of progress. But we don't see any signal of obvious split within the army.
You concur with that?
Yeah, I don't think we don't really know, to be honest. We don't have that good of information, but we don't see any obvious signs of split.
The gentleman right here in the front. Just speak right into it.
Well, as a sideline to the
Can you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry?
Could you identify yourself?
I'm Joseph Poser, member of the Asia Society.
That's nice. You should all join the Asia Society, too.
As a sideline to the regime and its apparent independence of outside influence, I might say that when we were in Mandalay 2 years ago, you were only allowed to exchange $100 per room each day, and with grudging, rather sour agreement on the part of the staff. So obviously the gas is providing the regime with all they need. But from the point of view of influencing the regime, certainly the United States seems to have virtually no leverage. The only country I know of who might, and that would be China, because China is a trading partner there. China is hungry for their oil. And it seems that we should be undertaking negotiations with the Chinese to do something about it.
Was that just a statement? I think we agree.
Just a comment to the last speaker. Thank you for a wonderful speech. But also to the United States government. It seems to me we've got to pick our partners on an issue in which we have absolutely no leverage.
Okay, before I get back there,
respond briefly. If you were to ask the Chinese, the Indians, the Japanese, the ASEANs, how many times we've talked to them about this, and they were to give you an honest answer, you'd be amazed.
I'd like to read an online question from Patrick Burns at Tokyo Shimbun, New York office, to Scott and Dr. Tan Thun. Since Gambari's mission seems to have brought back no concrete achievement, his last mission, and the U.S., France, and the U.K. are seeking another presidential statement condemning the regime, so far that effort has been blocked. What should the role of the Security Council be in the weeks leading up to the election? Should the UN be in charge of monitoring the election in May?
Well, we're talking, in fact, I'll be talking to people tomorrow morning, but our team here at the UN is talking to others on the Security Council about other things that the Security Council can do to try to encourage the regime and to move in the right direction. In terms of the role of the UN in the referendum, Mr. Gambari suggested to the Burmese regime international monitors, and they rejected it. It's hard, given what we all know about Burma, to imagine anything close to a credible referendum if there's nobody there watching the officials counting the ballots. So if they want to have a referendum that has any credibility among their own population as well as the international community,
yes, you would think they would want international monitors. We would certainly support that, whether they be UN or other. But it's the decision up to the regime.
I hate to defend the regime, but actually they pulled off a free and fair election in 1990. They just didn't honor it. So they do know how to run them.
Yeah. We kind of think if they have a free and fair one this time, maybe they could honor it. Just maybe they can trade off.
The lady with the microphone back there, yes.
Thank you. I just wanted to say...
Who are you?
Fleur Lee. I'm just somebody who was born there Jesu in Mingalaba. I just wanted to say, I had a question about tourism. There's been mixed statements over the last 30 years about people's role coming into the country. I know that the U.S., there are people who come, but mainly it's the Dutch, Australians, the French, and the German. So does anybody on the panel have a advice or in terms of if you do visit the country, how you should be spending your money since a lot of the businesses are owned by the military and have connections with or you have to have, you know, connections with the military to even have a business? And I think a second question related to that is if you're living in the United States and would like to assist, how can you get involved? So those are my two questions.
Assist in what?
In the political
regime
effort.
Change?
In the regime change and just the reason why we're all here today to listen and understand what's going on in Burma.
Maybe, Sean, you should take the first question and Dr. Tung Tun the next one, the second one.
Right. The tourism one, of course, is a vexed one, as you said. And I think there's a mix of things that are at issue there. If you are concerned that the funds could end up in the hands of the regime, then obviously the answer, if you then decide to go, firstly, I think that then poses a question about whether you should go or not. If you then decide that you want to do that, then clearly what you need to do is try and avoid the large tourism complexes and hotels and so on, because rest assured they will be owned by the military or people connected to them. So I think those decisions are should be made on that basis. There's all sorts of advice to that, to various effect from the elected representatives, and so Thong Tun, I'd be interested in your comments on that. So that's essentially that issue. I think it's interesting that perhaps the issue is less important to the regime now than it was before, simply because they were desperate for every skerrick of foreign exchange before, and I don't think that's the case anymore. So perhaps, there's been a bit of change on that front.
Dr. Dantun?
Yeah. Whether you should visit Burma or not, it depends on what type of, what is your purpose, if it is just kind of package tour to see the landscape or to see the beautiful, to go to the beautiful beach, first thing is, of course, you will definitely give part of the money to the regime. Of course, there can be some small amount to the locals. Second, you will not know anything about the, life of the people because, you cannot have the chance to interact with the people. So if the purpose is just to have interaction, to know about the life of the people, and then you can bring out the message, to the international community, how you witness the economic and social life of the people, what are their aspirations, so it can be useful.
What about the second question about what can you do here?
Here, I think, of course...
joint demonstrations?
You can share your knowledge and promote awareness. No, of course, the U.S. government is doing their best. We don't need to tell the U.S. government to do more. They are doing the best. But in New York, we have other embassies and other members of the U.N. So you can appeal to them, to do more in case of Burma.
As individuals, I work for a foundation. We always say you should at least stay informed. Especially if you're born in Burma, you can get a free daily news service called Burmanet.org. It would start with there.
I'm Don Weatherby, a retired professor. it strikes me that listening to the discussion that the generals are not going to change their mind about anything. I mean, Tan Shui and the people, they're set on their course of action. That they have the capabilities to make sure that they're not going to be turned over by the people of Burma themselves unless there's a real revolution. The expressions of hope that somehow the international community is going to be able to pressure the Burmese seems rather thin from what has been said. I find it unbelievable that anybody would think that China is going to do anything to pressure the Burmese after Tibet. In a sense, I think forestalls that. Thailand is going to be the chair of ASEAN in 2008-2009. Prime Minister Samak just came back a week ago Sunday, all kissy-kissy with Tan Shui, saying that things were peaceful and stable, that he was a good Buddhist, and he meditates. The Thai foreign minister said Thailand's national interest is our business in Myanmar, and that comes well before human rights. So ASEAN's not going to do anything. So my question, Maureen, there is a question. My question is, given this, does the panel really believe that the generals are not going to have their way on the referendum, on the election in 2010, that in fact they're going to be able to continue on their course, and really there's very little, if anything, that the international community can really do to change this?
I want to quote Paulo Pinheiro, the special rapporteur to Myanmar. He said on the 14th, just recently, he said something about, you'd have to believe in gnomes and elves to think that the regime is really going to change. So he said that on the record in front of his huge, you know, Human Rights Council. So would you like to comment on, comment what, just sort of like, oh, it's a question.
I'll start. I think a couple comments. First, you know, it's hard to predict what happens. A military regime, not particularly these generals, but a military regime has been in power since 1962. Since at least 1988, there's been considerable efforts inside of Burma and internationally to try to bring about reform, and it hasn't happened yet. So obviously, everybody knows, everybody up here, we all know, this is an incredibly difficult challenge. Second, we also know that you can't always predict how things are going to, what's going to happen. I don't think any of us predicted the Saffron Revolution in September. So you can't, I would be foolish to say, yes, you know what, within 6 months it's all going to change. I think what you do is you try to pressure where you can, you try to make your arguments, you try to, you hope that some in the regime will be patriots and care about their country and not want it to see it go continuing down the negative path. I think there is concern in the region, including, I would say, in China, about the way things are going. The Chinese are not going to adopt sanctions and these sorts of things, of course. So I think the answer is it's very hard, but we keep trying, and the Burmese people are trying, and things change. But it's very hard to predict when and how.
Do you guys want to comment or take a question? Yep. Go ahead.
I would like to say that it will be the mistake for the regime if they dream that they will be able to smoothly implement the roadmap. I mean, the referendum and you know, that new election. You know that if they don't open up the process, we can foresee the strong resistance. We should not look at the Saffron Revolution as a sort of failure. You know, there are benefit coming out of you know, Saffron Revolution. The two big things. One is that Saffron Revolution provided the opportunity to bring the new generation into the, you know, process of democratic struggle. Because when we talk about the 1988 uprising, at the time they were just about 5 years old, 6 years old, 9 years old. But now they themselves witness, you know, that people struggle and regime's brutality and, you know,
And then that makes them to carry on the movement, you know. So that's one thing. And second is that killing of the monks in the streets, in the eyes of the public, that makes the regime, especially the Burma army, morally bankrupt. You know, the previously, you know, even non-political sector of the society, you know, they become, you know, resistant. You know, they become angry when they see that the monks have been killed. Now, previously, only the young monks were politically active. Now, even senior monks started to be involved. The one example is not just inside the country, in exile. You know, before Saffron Revolution, most of the monks in exile refrained from being involved in the movement. But after the Saffron Revolution, the well-known Sayado from Penang, nearly 80 years old, well-respected internally, internationally, he formed the International Monk Association, and they started a campaign, bringing all the exiled monks together. And then with them, you know, they have their own constituency audience and the expatriate community. That kind of movement of the monks, senior monks, have sort of psychological impact, not only the general public, but also within the army, even though, you know, the majority, silent majority within the army doesn't say anything in public, you know, they will be psychologically affected.
Don, don't forget Indonesia, Chile, Argentina. What about the Soviet Union before it cracked up? I mean, it was unthinkable, right? So, I mean, you have to know, you just have to have faith that it can also happen to Burma. Back there.
Thank you. Christina Moon from 8808 for Burma. First, Maureen, I wanted to sort of try to answer your question. From my understanding of Buddhist study and meditation practice, suffering is considered the gateway to compassion. And rather than this just being sort of the karmic curse on the Burmese people, I think that it's a great gift that we have the potential to unlock that the people of Burma can give to the rest of us. My question, since I'm running a campaign that's aimed at encouraging China to take on a role of global leadership to resolve the human rights crisis in Burma, since President Bush is going to the opening ceremony of the Olympics, and there's a lot of pressure on China on multiple fronts on the Olympics, isn't that forum a very valuable, or, you know, what sort of opportunities can we see from that forum and from what China aims to get out of the Olympics in terms of encouraging them to take on a role of shared responsibility to resolve the situation in Burma? Thank you.
So, Scott, I think you should try that first.
Well, I don't remember the exact words, but what President Bush has said is that the something to the effect that that the Olympics are an event that shine a light on the host nation, and so in this case they will shine a light on China, and is an opportunity for China to show what kind of player it is at home and in the international community. So, you know, we'll have to see how China addresses that. But as I said earlier, we've been talking to the Chinese regularly at many levels and very senior levels about, well, there's always a very long list of things to talk to China about, but this is certainly one of them. And the fact is, I mean, China is a big player in the region and the world now, and a lot of the issues in the world we need to work with the Chinese on, and we are.
Gentleman in the red tie back there.
John Allen from Greater China Corporation. Do the Burmese people have access to the internet? And if so, how is that influencing change?
Have Burmese people have access to internet to some extent, but the number of population is very, very limited if we compare with our neighboring countries. But, you know, the saffron, the images and information coming out from Burma at the time of Saffron Revolution showed that how the new generation cleverly used the internet. You know, most of the information were smuggled out through the internet. Footages were posted to the blogs, and you know, there is the network of young generation bloggers, and you know, they used to have chat and interaction about the situation of the country. Even you know that sharing of information and where demonstration is going on, and which place where they should go and join. That sort of message was sent through internet, as far as I know.
Gentleman up front.
My name is Jeffrey Dow. What role do the various rebel armies that are currently operating in the country at some degree, what role could they play in the future? And I don't know if you're allowed to talk about this, but does the U.S. government have any contact with, the Karen rebel army or the Wu state army? Or I know there's a whole bunch of them out there.
Well, I can answer that part. Look, we want a unified Burma. We very much favor a Burma that stays unified and with an end to ethnic conflict. And a lot of this, of course, a lot of this conflict has been going on for decades, which goes back to the point I was making earlier. The solution is for the regime to reach out to these people and engage them in a reasonable way. I think things have changed a lot in terms of how the different ethnic groups view the situation and willingness to participate in a united Burma. So we are not supporting armed rebellion in Burma. We don't want to see violence. We want to see a unified Burma. But the other part of that is that it's really incumbent on the regime to bring these people into the process so they can participate fully and fairly.
Yes. Of course, you know that most of the resistant groups, in terms of military power, they became very weak, you know, that in the last 20 years. But still, you know, that the ethnic nationalities are one of the key forces. That's why regime is saying that how their national convention having involved my many ethnic delegates, especially actually they are the handpicked people, but they are using the ethnic cards to legitimize their political process. So, you know, at the time of the referendum, we started to hear the voices of the ethnic nationalities about their unhappiness to the constitution-making process, and you know, some groups started to say that they cannot accept the constitution. So if they come up with a unifying voice, you know, that this constitution is not acceptable, it will be the very big political blow to the regime. That's one thing I want to give comments. Another is that the myth about the Balkanization, you know, that has been advocated by the regime for many years. Actually, that is the sort of exaggeration. You know, as far as we discuss with all the ethnic groups, they are willing to live together, you know, within the union under the federal framework. If we accommodate some of their interest, you know, there is no threat of national disintegration, or there is no scenario like Balkanization in Burma.
There's two more questions, and one of them, I'm sorry, is going to be an online question, because it's a very interesting one, even though the person is anonymous, because concealing identity to continue traveling to Burma. So, but we'll read it anyway, because it's interesting. What he's saying is, why can't we create a reason for the military to work with us? That is much in the same way that they want to work with China. And this for you, Scott. It says, the longer that they remain outside their sphere of influence, the less impact we can hope to have on the country in the long and short term. Are there no influential voices in Western policymaking calling for substantial engagement with the military? There are some secret things going on. You don't have to answer this.
Yeah. I wish it was that mysterious. You know, it's not as if this is a situation that people seem to have. Some people seem to have a misperception that the Burmese generals are clamoring to engage with us and we're holding them off. And I wish that were the case. You know, we do have an embassy in Rangoon. The Burmese government has an embassy in Washington. We do have limited but some conversations with them. We've made it very clear that, you know, our goal in life is not to maintain sanctions and hurt Burma. Our goal is for Burma to join with the rest of ASEAN and move it in a positive direction. And we would be, you know, we're very interested. The reason we're so engaged is to try to help Burma. But the generals, I mean, they don't need to come to us. They need to come to their own people first and foremost. If they do that and they begin some kind of genuine process that you know, begins to move toward a transition, we can be very, and we will be very supportive of that. We're not, as I said, our goal in life is not to be the enemies of the Burmese government.
So, well, maybe some of them are watching this live webcast. We'll take one more question. The gentleman right in the... I'm sorry. Okay, if it's real quick, these two gentlemen, and then we all need a drink.
I have a quick question.
Who are you, sir?
Manik Mehta from India. I'm a journalist.
Okay.
There have been rumors, particularly in Sweden, that China is building up naval bases in Burma. Is that true? Would you have any information about that? And these bases are supposed to be along the Bay of Bengal.
Okay.
I honestly don't know. I haven't heard that.
There's lots of rumors about bases, right?
Yeah, the only comment I might make about that, which is not so much bases, but certainly there's a lot of activity in the Bay of Bengal because, of course, that's where this Shui gas is coming on shore in Arakan and a place called Ramri Island. And so there's quite a bit of competition at the moment between China and India to rehabilitate port facilities in Arakan. So to some extent, I think some of that probably mixes in with the story of naval bases and so on as well.
One last question, quick. By this gentleman in front. Wait, hang on.
My name is Murray Fromson. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I'm a professor emeritus from the University of Southern California. But in my younger life, I was a correspondent in Burma and Bangkok in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, in and out of these places. And I saw a lot of what happened in Burma. I'm a little bit more optimistic about the future because I think ultimately military regimes collapse of their own. They just do. But I remember that we had wonderful journalists in Rangoon, Ed Loyon of The Nation and other people like that, intellectuals. Burma was a thriving society 30, 40 years ago. And I think it doesn't help us to talk only about the weaknesses of the Burmese. To talk about the weaknesses of the United States, the U.S. policy. I mean, Burma is where it is because of Cold War policy. I saw this myself, and I think you have to really understand what has gone on for years. I mean, I covered the fighting between the Karens and the Kachins and the Shans in central Burma, and I covered the Chinese invasion of Burma. You know, the turmoil that's gripped the country hasn't given it a chance to really thrive. And I think with some really important policy on the part of the United States now, and the outside powers, is to help the Burmese intellectual class and the monks and people like that to do the best they can to really kind of keep the pressure on and hope that things will evolve. It's very sad to see what's going on.
So, Murray, that's a statement, right?
What's that?
That's a statement. That's a comment.
That's a statement. And a
that's
comment
all right.
And all that.
That's good. Yeah. We're doing that actually. That's what our foundation does. Monks and students. I think we're going to have to call it a night. Thank you very much, Dr. Tantun, Scott, and Sean, and all of you.